You're listening to the Biographics Podcast. This episode is something that originally aired on a YouTube channel we do. If you'd like to get the latest videos before they come to the podcast form, please do consider heading over to YouTube and just plug in Biographics, spelt the same way that this podcast's name is spelt, and you will see all of our videos. They were designed for video first, but we just wanted to make them accessible to people in the podcast format. So please consider doing that. Also, if you'd like to leave us a review, a rating, wherever you get your podcasts, that would be amazing. It really does help us out. It gets this in front of more people, which is always a good thing. It really keeps us making it. I like reading the reviews. So there's that. And let's get into today's episode.
It was one of the greatest states in history. In the early 20th century, the Austro-Hungarian Empire dominated Central Europe. At its height, it stretched all the way from modern-day Montenegro right up to the Czech-German border. Ruled for centuries by a succession of Habsburg emperors, it seemed as permanent as the United States does today. Yet in late 1918, in the blink of an eye, this great empire collapsed. The man who kicked its foundations out? Well, that would be an inexperienced 31-year-old dilettante known to history as Karl I, the last emperor of Austria. Before he dynamited his own empire, Karl had been an obscure royal from a side branch of the Habsburg dynasty, but a combination of freak tragedies had seen him propelled to the height of power. Made emperor before he was even 30, Karl inherited an empire on the losing side of one of the greatest wars in history. In his short reign, he first tried to hold his disintegrating world together before finally surrendering to its destruction. An emperor who killed his empire, a soldier who may become a saint. This is the fascinating story of Austria's last emperor. Fitting for a man whose reign revolved around war, Karl's story started with a bullet. Well, specifically, it started with two bullets. Two shots fired in a palatial hunting lodge outside Vienna one cold, miserable night in January 1889. Earlier that day, the disturbed young heir to the Austrian throne, Crown Prince Rudolf, had requested his 17-year-old lover join him at the lodge. There, the two made a suicide pact before Rudolf shot her and then turned the gun on himself. The death of the heir shook the empire. It created a scandal that engulfed Vienna and emotionally broke the Emperor Franz Joseph. But it did something else too. It set Karl on a collision course with destiny. Born a year and a half earlier, on August the 17th, 1887, Karl was a young boy from a side branch of the Habsburg royal family. His father, Archduke Otto, was the nephew of Emperor Franz Joseph and younger brother of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. But while both the Franzes were famous for their pious Catholic lifestyles, Karl's father was infamous for treating life like one giant frat party. He drank, he caroused, he had affairs that scandalized Austria. Naturally, this didn't sit well with his wife. Princess Maria Josepha was a strict Catholic who couldn't believe her real-life Disney prince had turned out to be Gaston minus the muscles. From the moment Karl was born, she avoided her husband in favor of her son, taking him to mass almost every day. It was a habit that would instill in the young boy a deep affinity for Catholicism. So that was the family setup, but not so abnormal tale of parental division that could have gone unchanged for decades, had Rudolf not fired those fatal shots. Since Ferdinand was childless, that meant Karl was now third in line to the throne. Well, technically, Franz Ferdinand was only childless because he was still young. It was fully expected that he would marry and start creating mini Habsburgs that would knock Karl back out of the running to be emperor. So no one made any special effort to start preparing Karl for life at the top. He was allowed to skip the standard Habsburg military upbringing and instead attended a regular school. But events would soon conspire to keep Karl's place in the succession. In 1900, Franz Ferdinand married Sophia Chartak. Now, Sophie was a Czech countess, but for a family as absurdly royal and as absurdly Austrian as the Habsburgs, Czech countess was practically synonymous with trailer trash tramp. Enraged by the match, Franz Joseph excluded Franz Ferdinand's future children from the line of succession. And just like that, it dawned on everyone that Karl one day really would be emperor. It was too late to stick Karl on the military track, so his parents allowed him to go to university in Prague and get a regular education. In the grand Czech city, Karl absorbed ideas and attitudes alien to his family, becoming a cosmopolitan reformist, even as he held on to his strong Catholicism. At first, the emperor must have consoled himself that the throne was still a long way from the boy's grasp, but, well, it soon got closer. On November 1st, 1906, Karl's father, Otto, passed away from syphilis, making Karl second in line behind only Franz Ferdinand. Now, all it would take would be a single accident, or say, a single assassin's bullet, and 19-year-old Karl would be the heir presumptive. No one knew it in 1906, but that assassin's bullet was already in Franz Ferdinand's future. And when it was finally fired, it was going to change the entire world. For the next 8 years, Karl suffered a crash course in the kind of lives Habsburg heirs were expected to live. With the young students now getting worryingly close to power, Franz Joseph abandoned his previous detachment and worked flat out to whip Karl into shape. The boy was removed from university, refused the chance to finish his degree, and dumped onto an emergency military track that saw him whisked away to garrisons all over the empire. He was also bumped into an arranged marriage with a bride the emperor thought was worthy, the suitably wealthy, suitably royal Zita of Bourbon-Parma. There's actually footage of the elderly Franz Joseph at the couple's wedding, watching them closely like a hawk suspicious its prey might run off at any moment. He needn't have worried. Despite their arranged marriage, Karl and Zita got along fine, bonding over their shared Catholic faith and interest in new ideas. But while Franz Joseph may have breathed a sigh of relief over the wedding, there were already signs of trouble. Although Karl was now having a normal Habsburg upbringing, no one was actually showing him how to run an empire. Franz Joseph kept him at arm's length from court, possibly on the assumption that Karl could learn later when Franz Ferdinand was emperor. It was a risky decision. By the time of Karl's wedding, Franz Joseph was already in his 80s. His relationship with his heir, Franz Ferdinand, was still in the sewer from the whole Sophie Chotek thing. If Franz Joseph wanted to pass any wisdom on, well, now was the time to do it. But maybe the emperor was simply too busy come 1911. After all, his empire was creaking at the seams. Although it was known as Austria-Hungary, the empire Karl would soon inherit was far bigger than just those two countries. Alongside Austria and Hungary, it also comprised modern-day Czech Republic, Slovakia, Slovenia, Croatia, and Bosnia, alongside parts of modern-day Montenegro, Italy, Poland, Serbia, Ukraine, and Romania. That meant a multicultural empire filled with different ethnicities, religions, and languages. It was this multiculturalism that had allowed Vienna to thrive in the 19th century. It was also what was now threatening to pull it all apart. Nationalism was on the rise across Europe. Within the empire, the biggest flashpoints were the succession-minded Czech lands and the newly acquired territory of Bosnia. The latter was especially volatile. Only annexed by the empire in 1908, its status as part of Austria-Hungary was a bit of a sore spot for many Bosnian Serbs who dreamed of joining Bosnia and Serbia into a single nation. But although Franz Joseph was aware of the problems in Bosnia, he seemingly didn't realize just how acute they had become until it was too late. On July 28, 1914, Karl's uncle, Franz Ferdinand, visited Sarajevo as part of his tour of Bosnia. While he was being driven through the city in an open-topped car, a young Bosnian Serb named Gavrilo Princip stepped out of the crowd and fired two shots. Just as Rudolf's two fatal shots had many decades before, these two shots fired in Sarajevo would change history. The assassination of Franz Ferdinand meant Karl became heir presumptive. Suddenly, from a minor royal, this boy of not yet 25 had been propelled to the very cusp of power. But no one, apart from Karl, was thinking about this in mid-1914. The assassination of Franz Ferdinand had already created much bigger problems. Convinced the Serbian government had been behind the murder, Franz Joseph declared war. This led to Russia coming to Serbia's aid, which led to Germany coming to Austria-Hungary's aid, which led to France coming to Russia's aid, and so on until the entire continent was marching to a military drumbeat. World War I had just begun, the deadliest conflict the human race had seen so far, and it would spend the next 4 years ravaging Europe. By the time it ended, in November 1918, Karl would be emperor of an empire that no longer existed. Despite now being heir to the throne, Karl was still technically a soldier. So when the largest war ever seen broke out, he did what soldiers do, he went off to fight. Although the Western Front gets all the English language press, the Eastern Front was no picnic. By the time Karl reached Galicia, the little slice of Ukraine the empire owned, the bloodshed had already reached staggering heights. Along the front, the Russian Empire was making mincemeat of the Austro-Hungarians. In the first 2 months of fighting alone, the Russians managed to push 300 kilometers into Austrian territory, capturing Lemberg, now known as Lviv, and killing over 100,000 Austrian soldiers. But while the Romanov family were sitting pretty in St. Petersburg, Karl witnessed the slaughter firsthand. To say it had an effect on the young man would be an understatement. We've read sources that say he tried praying on the battlefield just to make the bloodshed stop. But if God was up there, he wasn't in the mood for listening. From September to May, the Russians battered the Austro-Hungarian army. As they did so, a few things became painfully clear to Karl. The first was that the army was weak not just because it was in urgent need of modernization, but because there was something rotten in Austria-Hungary itself. The siren song of nationalism was fraying the empire's bonds, making its different ethnicities mistrustful, unwilling to fight as a team. The second was that the main threat to the army might not be the marauding Russians, but rather getting swallowed by the German war machine. During the Gorlice-Tarnow offensive in mid-1915, Karl saw firsthand how it was only with German firepower that the Empire was capable of fighting on. Over the next 18 months, Karl toured the various fronts of World War I, noting with increasing alarm the Empire's growing problems. In northern Italy, he saw how ready to throw off the Habsburg yoke as subjects were. On the Eastern Front, he watched as Russian manpower smashed the Austro-Hungarian armies until their morale was just non-existent. By late 1916, it was badly clear that even if the Central Powers won, the stress of fighting might kill the Empire stone dead. What was desperately needed was someone new in charge, someone with a vision for how to stop the slaughter and pacify the Empire's many ethnic groups. Naturally, Karl assumed that he should be that someone, and he was about to get that chance. In the early hours of November the 21st, 1916, Emperor Franz Joseph passed away in his bedchamber in Vienna after ruling the empire for nearly 68 years. Immediately, Karl was recalled from the front, arriving in Vienna shortly after. There, amid the cold grandeur of the imperial city, he was proclaimed Karl I, Emperor of Austria. At the moment he took the title, he was only 29 years old. From the go, Karl was determined to act on the lessons he'd learned on the front. That meant ending the war, and ending it soon. He even insisted on having the following phrase inserted into his coronation proclamation: "I will do everything to banish, in the shortest possible time, the horrors and sacrifices of war, to win back for my peoples the sorely missed blessings of peace." But despite the new emperor's grand dreams, the reality was that peace just wasn't his to give. By winter 1916, Austria-Hungary was completely reliant on Germany, and the chances of the Kaiser agreeing to peace were somewhere around the chances of the Kaiser agreeing to put on heels and do a little dance for Karl in a Berlin nightclub. But Karl was not to be deterred. Even as he was hastily arranging his separate coronation in the Hungarian half of the empire, the young emperor was coming up with a dangerous plan. The Kaiser would let Karl pursue peace, then Karl was just going to have to go over the old man's head to get it. If Karl wanted his empire to make peace with the Allies, the first thing he had to do was make sure it survived long enough. The disease of nationalism had by now spread to Vienna itself. Fearing the divisions if ultra-right Austrians were given too much control, Karl made one of his first acts hiring prominent Czechs into his cabinet. It was a move meant to neutralize the threat of Czech secession. Instead, it just meant Karl became as unpopular with the Austrians as he was with everybody else. And unpopular was exactly the last thing that Karl wanted to be right now. That March 1917, the February Revolution shook Russia, toppling the Tsar. And yes, we agree it's confusing that a revolution named after the month of February took place in March. You can blame Imperial Russia's weird love affair with the Julian calendar for that one. Anyway, the wrong month revolution put the fear of God into Karl, who started to worry that he might be next if he didn't get that whole peace thing sorted out. He got his wife, Zita, to contact her brothers, Sixtus and Xavier, who were already fighting on the Allied side. He then gave them a secret note to hand to the French, telling them Austria-Hungary wanted to make peace. Today, the Sixtus affair is infamous for making Karl look like a bit of a jackass. But back in March and April of 1917, it briefly looked like the key to ending the war. When the French received Karl's overtures, they laid out a list of cautious demands as a precondition for talks. When Karl immediately agreed to most of them, the French contacted London, being all like, "Whoa, this guy's actually serious." Everyone was so excited by the messages that British Prime Minister Lloyd George remarked, "That means peace." But of course, Lloyd George was wrong. While Karl was happy to leave Germany hanging, willing to return land to Serbia, and willing to recognize French claims to new territory, he just couldn't bring himself to give up the Habsburgs' last remaining chunks of Italy. Since Italy was demanding he do just that in return for peace, the secret negotiations eventually fizzled. With hindsight, Karl's actions were pretty super dumb. Austria-Hungary's holdings in Italy were already small. While abandoning them would have been a bitter pill to swallow, it could have allowed the empire to survive. But that was just one of Karl's contradictions. He was a wannabe peacemaker, but he was also the guy who literally thought the Catholic God had appointed him to rule an indivisible empire. With that mindset, surrendering territory was always going to be a bit of a non-starter. But even though Karl's negotiations fell through, it wasn't the end of the Sixtus affair. On January 8, 1918, Woodrow Wilson set out his 14 points for peace in Europe, including self-determination for all peoples of Karl's empire, a move that almost guaranteed its dissolution. When Karl subsequently tried to make a more strident tone against the Allies, the French published his secret letters. This is the bit of the Sixtus affair that everyone remembers, and it was as embarrassing as it sounds. For the Allies, this was final proof that Austria-Hungary was close to collapse. For Germany, it was nothing short of betrayal. That May, the Kaiser angrily summoned Karl. In a special meeting, he forced the young emperor to put the Austro-Hungarian military totally under Berlin's control. With the empire now little more than a German vassal state, the writing was on the wall. There was no way Karl was escaping this quagmire without some serious consequences. But not even the failed emperor could have foreseen just how serious those consequences would be. Across 1918, Karl tried his best to shore up support inside his ailing empire. He introduced military reforms, banned flogging, tried to halt the use of poison gas. On the domestic front, he set up a welfare system for returning soldiers and tried to demilitarize his society. But it was too little, too late. When Austria-Hungary entered the war, it was not a given that it would collapse. Had Karl's peace efforts succeeded in 1917, it seems likely some form of the empire would have survived, minus its Italian, Serbian, and probably Polish and Czech parts, but it would have still been an empire. By fall 1918, though, that ship had long since sailed. On October the 16th, Karl published a manifesto broadly accepting Wilson's 14 points, declaring the creation of a federal empire and granting every nationality autonomy. But it was all just theater. By now it was clear that World War I was in its endgame, and it was clear who was on the losing side. Just 12 days after Karl published his manifesto, on October the 28th, the Czechs took control of Prague and declared their independence. The very next day, Croatia and Slovenia unilaterally seceded. The day after, Slovakia jumped ship. That same day, Austria's politicians declared the creation of a new national parliament, effectively taking Austria out of its own empire. Within 24 hours, Hungary's new leaders had dissolved the treaty, joining their country with Austria. On November the 11th, with only a handful of fragments of his empire left, Karl gave up on trying to hold on. He renounced his right to rule Austria, released his subjects from their oath of loyalty, and announced that he would retreat from politics. It wasn't quite an abdication, but it was very, very close. As the guns fell silent along the front at 11 a.m. that same day, Austria-Hungary officially ceased to exist. It seems Karl still had hope at this point, hope his grateful subjects would recall him for his peace efforts and ask him to lead them once again. It was a nice fantasy, but, well, fantasy was all it was. While some call Karl the peace emperor today, the fact is that he totally failed in his goal of making peace. World War I had just shattered Europe. It had claimed over 20 million lives. No one, but no one, wanted to be led by one of the guys who was on the losing side. Come March 1919, even Karl seemed to recognize this. At the end of that month, he and Zita boarded a train bound for Switzerland and set off for a lonely life as exiles. In the wake of their departure, the Austrian National Parliament passed a law banning all Habsburgs from the country and stripping them of their right to the throne. Any sensible person would see this was the end, that this video was coming to its close, that the credits are about to roll on Karl's life. But Karl wasn't sensible. He was an idealist and a man who thought God had handpicked him for greatness. As he crossed the Swiss border, the deposed emperor issued his Feldkirch Manifesto, revolving around his own decision to step down and announcing that he would return to lead Austria-Hungary again. It was a moment as brazen as it was foolish. It was also a moment that would soon plunge the shattered empire right back into chaos. Although with hindsight, we can see that Karl's reign was over, things weren't so certain in 1919. France actually toyed with restoring him and rebuilding his empire as a counterweight to Germany. It was just spitballing, but word somehow got back to Karl, whose takeaway was that Paris would support him retaking the throne by force. The only problem was, there wasn't a throne for him to go back to, or was there? In World War I's aftermath, Hungary very quickly went through a phase of communist rule, which ended with everyone really super keen to sort of do the exact opposite of communism. In February 1920, Miklos Horthy came to power, restored the monarchy, and named himself regent in Karl's name. For Karl, this was a clear signal that the Hungarians at least wanted him back, and he wasn't totally mistaken. But there was one Hungarian determined to make sure that Karl never retook his throne. Horthy may have restored the monarchy, but only as a means to power. After all, what's a regent when his king is capable of ruling? Well, that's a nobody. So when Karl snuck back into Hungary in disguise on March the 26th, 1921, Horthy did everything in his power to keep the young man from unseating him. When they met, he told Karl that of course he supported him, that of course he'd help him march on Budapest. Then, when the emperor was good and mollified, Horthy snuck off and asked the French if they were, like, actually serious about supporting Karl. To Horthy's delight, the French were not serious about it at all. Paris announced they'd had no part of this, and Karl was both an idiot and on his own. This delighted Prague, and the Czechoslovaks immediately threatened to declare war on Hungary if it restored the emperor. And that is how Karl wound up fleeing into exile in Switzerland for the second time. But the last emperor, he wasn't done trying just yet. That fall, Karl contacted Hungary's elites, making sure to exclude Horthy. He managed to drum up an army of 5,000 loyalists. On October the 20th, the emperor flew a plane to the border town of Sopron, where his army was waiting for him. Initially, the venture had all the hallmarks of a glorious homecoming. The people of Sopron celebrated Karl's return. As his army began the long march to Budapest, more and more joined their ranks. For one shining moment, it really looked like Karl was going to get his empire back. And then the army reached Budapest, and everything fell apart. No one quite seems sure what happened that strange day. We've seen sources claim Horthy tricked the citizens into taking up arms against Karl, believing he was at the head of a Czechoslovak invasion force. We've seen others say that Karl was betrayed by one of his generals. The only thing certain is that Karl entered Budapest on October the 23rd. By October the 24th, he'd been captured, and his last chance at restoration was over. This time, it wouldn't end with comfy exile in Switzerland. On November the 1st, the irate British sailed a warship up the Danube and demanded Karl be handed over. They then took him away, away from Hungary, away from mainland Europe, away to the Portuguese island of Madeira, some 900 kilometers from the mainland. And they left him there. On April the 1st, 1922, Karl succumbed to pneumonia, some sources say Spanish flu, and passed away, aged just 34. At the time he died, his name was mud across Europe. His former nations had all passed laws banning him from their territory. He was seen as a weakling at best and a laughingstock at worst. But things soon started to change. In the aftermath of World War II, with its overtly evil trio of Hitler, Mussolini, and Stalin, a bumbling Habsburg who'd sincerely tried to make peace suddenly didn't look so bad. As World War I began to be viewed as a gigantic, needless, morally grey screw-up, Karl's determination to end the war eventually began to appear decent, even noble. In 2004, over 80 years after Austria's last emperor died in misery, Pope Jean-Paul II beatified him for his peacemaking efforts. As of the time of writing this episode, Karl is on the path to sainthood. Is it the fate he deserves? Who can say? While Karl really did try to make peace, he was also really a bit of an ineffectual bumbler, and he failed to end the war that his empire was a part of. They say that all it takes for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. What they neglect to mention is that sometimes good men can really try to do something and still fail to stop the slaughter. Karl may have been a decent man deep down, but if his story shows us anything, it's that decency isn't always enough. Sometimes you can do everything in your power to hold your country together, and you can still wind up being known to history as the last emperor.
So I really hope you enjoyed that episode of the Biographics Podcast. leave us a review. Why not? You can do that wherever you get your podcasts or a rating or however these things work. I like reading them. It makes me feel good when they're positive. It lets me know what you don't like when they're negative. Also, if you want to say hi, say, let me know how I'm doing with this podcast, just drop me an email. It's simon@biographics.org. Biographics spelled the same way that the name of this podcast is spelled. So again, that's simon@biographics.org. Drop me an email, say hi, let me know how you like this podcast. And as always, I'll see you next time.